And now for reading and writing and radio.
My perfect place is in the top of my uncle's hay barn. It is nice and silent, so you can think.
Those sentences about a favorite place were written by Doug Wiggers when he was in Mrs. Ray's sixth grade class, Butler School, Springfield. But they could be by you. WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University.
Doug wrote only a few sentences about his uncle's barn, but what a rush of feeling there was for me when I read them, because the round barn on the farm where I grew up in southern Wisconsin was my perfect place, too. We did lots of playing in that round barn, but also lots of lying and dreaming and being silent and watching the sunlight sifting through the windows with the dust motes floating in the air from the hay both soft and scratchy, the cobwebs that festooned the massive structure of the wood beams that arched out from the top of the barn, the silo in the center and those beams coming down like a great umbrella. The barn, and on that fat silo in the middle of the barn, my grandfather had painted the aims of this farm: good crops, proper storage, profitable livestock, a stable market, life as well as a living. That barn, that silo, has been the center, sort of the center of my life, from which everything else has fanned out. At this point, I want to pause and introduce a friend that's here with me. Sarah Wiseman is a friend of the family and of my oldest daughter, Demi, and she's going to school at Illinois State, and she's here visiting. She plays the cello, as do I, and writes. And Sarah, why don't you say hello and a word or two?
Hello. My favorite remembrances are also from Wisconsin, so I'm glad she's talking about it. Go ahead.
Okay. And Sarah, you feel free to butt in any time you want and comment on what we're saying, because you're here sort of spontaneously. And so we'll go on. When I was in eighth grade, they had an art contest in our school, and it was called What America Means to Me. And I tried to paint the farm that I grew up on, and I really took too ambitious a project. I tried to paint the whole blasted thing, the barns and the houses and the fields and so forth, and it was a choppy sort of painting, and my teacher didn't like it. She kept coming around and frowning when she'd look at it, so I knew that she didn't like it. And so finally I gave up on painting what America really meant to me, which was my farm, and I painted a ballot box with different hands, men's, women's, working hands, soft hands, black hands, brown hands, yellow hands, all holding their vote over the box, and this was met with great approval, a sort of a trite idea, but I got an honorable mention on it. And yet at that time, America didn't mean to me that everyone had the right to vote. I wasn't old enough to vote. I had heard that voting was a very important thing in this free society, but my heart still doesn't go out in a rush when I think about a ballot box, even though I know that it's important. My heart goes out in a rush to a barn, to Doug's barn, to my barn. And I'd like today, well, this is our first program of 1976. This is our bicentennial year, and we've been building up to the bicentennial for quite a long time, and I'm sure you've all been doing things in social studies and in your other classes, Betsy Ross and Paul Revere and things like that. It's in all the media. It's in the comics. I chuckled over Sally the other day when she was deciding she wanted something that would sell. And she thought, well, if she painted a picture of a tennis match between George Washington and Betsy Ross on one side, mixed doubles with President Truman and Billie Jean King on the other, she thought maybe that would sell. And Charlie Brown says, Truman and Billie Jean would take them in straight sets, or something like that. Anyway, we have a bicentennial going on all the time. And all these things, these stories and studies of the past that we've been doing to remind us of the background of our country and what it means to us, these are well and good, and I'm glad that we're doing them. But what I'd like to do today is to take a bit of a different angle, not to go into the past, or else not very far, no farther for me than the some 40 years of my life, and for you, the 8 or 11 or 14 years. And of course your teachers, because teachers, we'd like you to write too. I have a colleague at Sangamon State, Phil Kendall, that's taught children's lit with me, the two of us together, and he asked me a while back if I'd ever wondered when I was a kid why my country was called Tis of Thee. And I laughed because I knew what he meant, and he went on to say, I always thought I lived in the United States, or at least in America, but in school and everywhere we sang My Country, Tis of Thee. And I've spelled it T-I-Z-A-T-H-E-E, one word, you know, like My Country, Albania, or My Country, Italy. My Country, Tis of Thee. And Phil said, it took me a long time to sort out what that song meant. And I have asked other people since then if when they were little kids that they were confused by My Country, Tis of Thee. And they agreed that they were. Well, what does America mean to me? I've said the barn, and I'd like to go on from that. There's another Peanuts story. You've noticed I quote Peanuts quite a bit. This time it's Linus. And Linus was saying in a strip quite a while back, I love mankind. It's people I can't stand. Well, of course, it's really the other way around, as you know by now and I know, that if you can love one person or two persons with their glories and their defects, their gentle smiles and winning ways and their nastinesses and that they pick their nose like you and I do and so forth, if you can love one person or two persons, then you can love humanity. Then you can love mankind. But to say, I love mankind in the abstract, it's very difficult. And I'd like to apply that to our country, Tis of Thee. When somebody says, I love America, I see a great big map, the kind that we pulled down in grade school, with pink and green states and so forth, and it's all sort of vague in certain states. I remember my sixth grade teacher talking about Chesapeake Bay as if we knew where Chesapeake Bay was, and I didn't have the faintest idea where Chesapeake Bay was. It was somewhere vaguely there on the East Coast. And, you know, I don't really love that map. It's too distant, and it's too cold, and when I sing of My Country, Tis of Thee, I don't want to sing about that map. But then, in the song, we come to the verse that says, I love thy rocks and rills, thy woods and templed hills. Now there is something that I can relate to. Did you ever go on a treasure hunt? We lived, as I've said, on this farm in southern Wisconsin, and there was a little creek that ran through the back pasture. And, you know, when kids are little, they stick pretty close to home, and as they get older, they begin to venture out more and more, whether they live in the town or in the country. And one day it occurred to my sisters and my brother and I, let's follow the creek. We'd never really been off the farm before, except, you know, on the roads with our parents and so forth. So we packed up lunches, and we headed out following that creek, and we followed through the next farm, and we got over into an area that we didn't know. And we came to a woods, and the woods was planted in straight rows, and they were catalpa trees. And the creek had willow trees right alongside it. We called it the catalpa forest, and it had these great and ancient willows that were hanging over the creek, and in the creek there were crawfish, and it was the nicest part of the creek that we had ever found. We called it Crick, by the way, and I still do. Here was this creek, and it was like finding Eden. We were in paradise, and from then on we made many a trip to the Catalpa Forest. There weren't very many rocks and rills. I see a sort of a little mountain stream, but that little creek up there in Wisconsin was a very precious place to us there at the Catalpa Forest. A couple years later, we moved up the road a mile and a half, and here I was in a whole new territory that I hadn't experienced before, fifth grade. And we moved in just as school started, and I recall that every night after school I'd come home and I would put on my blue jeans, and we had just gotten a new dog. He'd been up at the vet's, someone had had to give him up, and he was an older dog. She, Lassie, was her name. And I would take this new dog, Lassie, and we'd go out on the lawn, and I would spin around until I was dizzy, like spin the milk bottle. I was the milk bottle, and end up pointing in a direction. And if it wasn't the direction we'd gone the night before, but a new direction, why then Lassie and I would start off in that direction. And we found all sorts of things in all sorts of different directions. I would go until I came to something interesting, and then stop and explore it. And the most exciting and interesting place was when I spun around and headed in the direction of what turned out to be a little woods that we later on called the Wood Tick Wood, because somebody got a tick in it once. And that place turned out to be even more heaven to me than the Catalpa Forest, which, by the way, I could still get to. It was between the two farms. And this little woods had everything. It had little meadowy places in it. It had tall trees in it. It had new trees in it. It had violets. It had some rocky outcroppings where you could sit. It had birds. It had a crow's nest at the top of one of the trees. And I loved that Wood Tick Wood with a real passion. I wrote a poem about it, and I dug the poem out of my notebooks, my briefcase that I kept everything I wrote from third grade on. The poem isn't really good enough to read to you. I'm a little embarrassed by it, but the first verse and the last verse might give you an idea. It starts out, "Every spring there comes a day, I never know when it will be, till I waken in the morning and it's there surrounding me. How can I think of schoolwork then when all my being yearns?" And then I go on talking about going to see the violets and the ferns and so forth, and talk about spending the day in the Wood Tick Wood and climbing the trees and this sort of thing. And then the last verse is, "And then at last, when evening comes, trailing her net of stars, I follow home the tangled fence and climb the pasture bars." Well, I really did that. My folks weren't strict about my going to school. I went practically every day, but if once in a while I decided I needed a vacation, why, nobody bothered me. And on that really first spring day, you know how it feels when your blood comes up in a different sort of way, like sap in the trees, and you simply can't be at a desk. I would take off. I'd pack my lunch, and I would go barefoot over the new plowed ground, and I would spend the entire day just being in this perfect, beautiful place, this Wood Tick Wood. A number of years later, when I was in high school, the farmer next to us chopped the whole wood down and turned it into a pig field. And I couldn't even look out my window for years because the pain was so great to see the absence of that woods over the hill, which had been there and had meant so much to me. Since then, my father has had a farm pond made down in our own back pasture, and woods have grown up there, and that has now become a very special place to all of us. So it's sort of taken the place of the Wood Tick Wood, and furthermore, it has water in it. I've always loved water, and I thought I'd read you a spot out of the Paleface Redskins that deals with another place that I love. I've mentioned before how we spent summers on a lake in southern Wisconsin called Pleasant Lake, and I've read you bits out of some of those books. Here is out of the Paleface Redskins, and Marcy, who is more or less me, is experiencing this place she loves, this lake. She's lying out on the rowboat, and it's a hot day. Not a breath of wind sandpapered the water. Bugs and leaves drifted, barely moving. Even the dust lay undisturbed on the surface where it fell. Marcy knelt in the bow of the old gray rowboat, her weight lifting the stern. Her chest leaned on the triangular seat that covered the prow, while her head poked out over the water and the tips of her pigtails grazed the surface. On either side, her arms hung limp, the elbows bathed in lukewarm water, but her hands in the cooler depths. The sun beat down hot on her back and glanced up from the water into her face. She was glad that she wasn't a Boy Scout who had to answer the notes of the trumpet. She didn't want to do anything at all except drift. She paddled a bit with her hands, staring down. The water was a little over her head. Bright green eelgrass fingers combed the slant sunbeams in undersea rhythm, and now and then parted to reveal a mossy rock. Little fish darted among the thick fronds. The bottom sloped down, and the rich grass swept up like Rapunzel's hair. Pale green strings of a different seaweed unwound themselves from the bottom and spiraled toward the surface. They grew closer and closer together till she could see nothing but their winding threads. Soon they would reach the surface, but now they just grazed her fingers. She pulled one, it was slimy, and watched while it slowly unwound, floated to the top, and stretched out in the sun. She glided over a new flower bed. Deep down, luxuriant seaweed crowded and shoved for space to grow. The broad leaves seemed made of crepe paper, pulled roughly at the edges, and the colors ranged from deep rust to the most delicate shades of pink, all with a blue-greenish, watery tinge. A turtle swam lazily above the dense weeds. She pictured herself in his world, paddling through the seaweed forest, a lush garden of the sort that must grow in steamy tropical jungles, and yet cool and quiet, swaying gently in the current breeze. Wildflowers, she mused, grew all jumbled on a hill, but seaweed seemed almost to have bounds. Who were the underwater gardeners? Who laid out the kaleidoscope of flower beds? And the story goes on as I have her floating over the lake and seeing more and more things. And then at the end, after she has swum some and she's lying in the water, she watched a hawk tilting motionless on the wind. She felt akin to him. They were both freed from the ground, buoyed up. They did not belong to the earth. He was part of the sky and she of the lake. With her eyes on the level of the water, she could survey the whole shore and see just what the lake saw. It was her watery body lapping at every inlet. She was the lake. Why did I write that passage, or the Paleface Redskins book, or the Ghost Boat book, which is also about the lake? I wrote them because I loved that spot, and I wanted the reader to love those places too. I wanted to put down what those spots meant to me. If we go to the Templed Hills, our families have had a long love affair with Vermont. One of my kids said, "Oh, Mom, I wish I'd been born in Vermont, and then the first thing that I'd have seen when I opened my eyes would have been Vermont mountains." And this morning I said, "Which of you kids was it that wanted to be married on top of Camel's Hump, which is a local mountain near us?" And Demi laughed, and she said, "All of us wanted to be married on top of Camel's Hump." And I had said, "Well, that's all very well. We can, most of us, if we're not too decrepit, climb up for the wedding, but what about the grandparents?" And they said, "Oh, well, we can fly them in with helicopter." I have here a poem that Megan wrote when she was 14 or 15 that's about the lake up there. "Everyone sleeps, but I am risen with the sun, and the grass wets with cold and freshness above my knees. Softly then, under the trees, through the fence, down now, to be seen is to be caught, scramble up a cliffside, scraping, stinging, and brambles holding me down. The trees at the top are quiet again, and up the hill to the open, rocks drying, warming, waiting for my curled body. Berries nestled deep in green leaves, field enclosed by trees, hidden, hiding me. Here I see the lake. It begins to wake. I watch and am watched by none but the birds." Our spots don't always have to be country or lake. They can be city, too. When we lived in downtown New Haven, we found spots there tucked away, a lumber yard that we enjoyed, a tiny park, a vacant lot with a tangle of bushes. Here in Springfield, there's a creek over by Stonington that's filled with watercress that I love. There's a treehouse out north of town that somebody built once that we call Nancy Blodgett's, and we go there sometimes and have a picnic up in this treehouse that's falling apart. These are all places that have become close to me, close to us, and that are what America means to me. So today in your writing, what I'd like you to do and what I'd like to hear from you is, what are your special places? What's the spot that has meaning for you? Why don't you tell in words or a poem, an essay, a story? Don't be general. Don't say, I love thy rocks and rills. Tell us which rock you love and why. Tell us about the corner of your backyard, your vacant lot, your stream, your ditch, your tree. For if a spot is special to you, it's yours, no matter who officially owns the place. Be sure to tell us why it's yours, why that small patch of earth or rock or grass or brick wall is special to you. For that's a strong part of what our country is to both you and to me. So 'tis of that let's sing today, but I've got one more thing I want to say before I end. When I talked about Linus and myself saying, if you love this plot of land, then you can love the whole of America, this little spot, let's extend that to the whole world. We're talking about the bicentennial, and I had a friend who said, I think we ought to get together for the bicentennial and write a declaration of interdependence. And I think if we can realize that we can love the whole of America because we love that barn, because we love that spot in the vacant lot, we can also understand how an English kid can love a piece of London or a piece of Dartmoor, how a French child can love a spot, how a Russian or a Chinese or a girl from Ghana, from South America, how all these people can love their own spots of land, and by so loving those spots of land can extend the love to the whole world. And so I would hope that when we sing My Country, 'Tis of Thee, we could include it, not stopping with the borders of our own United States, but to loving the whole world.
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.